Good morning, good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys, and I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. Also, want to let you know we're on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, and here at Blog Talk Radio. So follow, rate, make comments, all of it is encouraged. This will be a pre-recorded interview with the sisters Maika Mulite and Maritza Mulite. They're authors of a book called One of the Good Ones. Both of them are getting their PhDs. Amazing. And then also being authors at the same time. They are natives of Miami and daughters of Haitian immigrants. Maika has a bachelor's in marketing from Florida and an MBA from the University of Miami. And Maritza Mulite is a graduate of University of Florida with a bachelor's in women's studies and a master's in journalism from the University of Southern California. Maika is getting her PhD at Howard University's Communication, Culture, and Media Studies program. And Maritza is getting her PhD at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's exploring ways to improve literacy in under-resourced communities after being inspired to study education from her time as a literacy tutor and a pre-K teacher assistant. I hope you enjoy the interview. Thank you.
It knows how your mind works. So it's like you're not alone in that space when you're digging in there trying to figure out how to make the story come alive. And for Maritza and I, we're the two oldest of four sisters. So the four of us are really tight, and it's like we speak our own language anyway. So writing a story together just makes that happen, but on the page.
What were some difficult points? Did you guys have any like conflict about what you wanted to keep or to take out of the book?
Mayuka and I have pretty similar, I guess, what do we call it, Mayuka? We pretty much really like the same things.
Sensibilities.
Yeah, we have very similar sensibilities. So we didn't have, especially for this book, much opinion, like differing opinions on what we wanted to happen. But we do have a general rule where if we do have opposite ideas of what the next step in the story should be, we will both duke it out and come and like state our cases to each other. And then whoever is most passionate, because there's usually someone who is way more passionate about whatever we're arguing about, that person will get their way in the story because we figure that is the best thing for the story.
So now you guys did not start out as writers. I mean, Maika, you have an MBA and you're trying to get your PhD in communications, culture, and media studies programs. And now Maritza, still trying to do PhD at UPenn to improve literacy in under-resourced communities. Is that something you're still doing?
Yes, we're first year PhD students right now.
So all of that, and then you've written two books. Wow. Like, when do you relax?
My sisters call me the sleepiest girl in the world because I always take naps.
Okay.
It's true. She is the sleepiest girl in the world. Or she thinks she
But
is.
you make time for the things that you want to make time for, right? So whether that's a relationship, family time, writing, going to school, whatever the case may be, if you want to do it, you'll figure out how to make the time. But before this, I got my PhD, excuse me, I got my MBA from the University of Miami, and right now I'm currently a PhD student at Howard University. And in addition to being a student at Howard, I'm also a teaching assistant. So it's a lot. There are definitely times when you're like, oh man, what did I I just said yes to everything at the same time. But we just kind of have to manage our time. So that might mean, some nights I'm up until really late. Like it might be 4 a.m., 5 a.m. trying to get something done. And then I know that I'll just like sleep in tomorrow, or I just manage my time throughout the day. But I think if it's something that's important to you, you'll get it done, especially with writing, because there are so many times you'll hear folks saying like, You know, it took them a really long time to write a book, and it's because life gets in the way, and sometimes you're busy, or if you have children, that can be a lot to deal with, or if you're working on top of it. But you carve out the times where you can, and you don't feel guilty when the inevitable moment comes where you can't, you know, you just kind of make it work. But we've been lucky enough that we've been able to juggle it all so far.
But also,
Yes, I just wanted to say that it's not like writing is this huge burden that we have to carry on our backs every single day. Like, this is a dream that we've had since we were children. So exactly. The fact that we are published authors and have the opportunity to speak to cool people like you and talk about our work is really a dream come true. So it's okay.
Well, that's good. So this story is dealing with, well, first it's like starts out with grief. It's dealing with teens, families. You have LGBTQ issues in there. You put racism in there. You got sibling rivalry. I mean, so many things. So let's start off with the first thing of grief. Talk about, Maika, maybe the grief that your family had gone through that preceded this book.
Yeah, so it's such a... And it's like, it's crazy how the world always comes together in a strange way, or how you'll notice connections like this. But for us, when we sat down to write One of the Good Ones, it was because we wanted to tackle just what it means to be a Black woman in America, you know, or a Black girl in America specifically, because our book is for a young adult audience. But really kind of what helped the story come together is that a few years ago, we had our great aunt who passed away. She was sick, and it was expected because she was an older woman and she had cancer. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of like, okay, we love her. And it was so much grief that we went through. And the day of the funeral, we were kind of walking through the mausoleum where she was buried. And we're looking at the names of different people who have passed who are on the wall. And one of the names there was Trayvon Martin. Mm. And it was really a surreal moment because my sisters and I, we remember when that case, if you will, came to be in the national consciousness. And we're from Miami. So, you know, where Trayvon Martin went to school, it was our home school. Like, we didn't live far from that school. At one point, he went to one of the schools that one of our sisters went to. And it was very much that the Miami that he grew up in was our Miami, right? And we followed this case closely because of this. You know, it felt like somebody that we knew who was brutalized in this way. And it just, it stuck on us and it stuck with us. And I think, we, you know, growing up as a Black person in America, you kind of know what it is here, right? Yeah, you know what it is to be a Black person. But I would say when Trayvon Martin was murdered, it opened my eyes in a way that maybe I had been able to kind of not ignore, but kind of push to the side. You're like, you know, this is the Black experience. This is what it is to be a Black person in America. But this hit so close to home, and it just it stuck with us. And I remember crying so heavily, and I was like, why do they do this to us? Like, you can't even be walking in your own community, you know, with a bag of Skittles, minding your business before somebody comes to you. It's like, it's crazy. So it was a combination of us going through our own grief of losing a family member and then seeing his name there. And just thinking like that's a family too, that's grieving and must live with this. And not only are they living with this, they're living with it in the public eye, and everything they say or do afterwards will be scrutinized. And that, and that really stayed with us. And that kind of really was something that we had in the back of our minds as we worked on this story.
Did you think about any teens, or did you use your sisters, the four of you, your relationship, Maritza, and put it in the book? Because there's three sisters in the book, they're not four. Are you one of the sisters? Like, you know what I mean? There's like the good one, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And then there's like the oddball out, and then there's like the OCD sister.
Yeah. So I would say that we aren't any of the sisters in this book. And I would also say that the four of us are pretty close. Like, we're very close. We're our own little unit. We like to say that if you're playing charades against us or any other game, we will beat you because we all share a grade.
You're going down.
Yes. Just be prepared for that.
Okay.
Yeah. And in the case of Kezi, Happy, and Jenny, there are tensions between the sisters in regards to Kezi and Happy and Jenny and Happy. And just there is more nuance there in what a sister is and isn't. And we wanted to explore something that would be a different experience than what we have. But at the same time, like, no one ever really fully knows another person, regardless of how close you are. So we wanted to explore sisterhood in flux in a way that is very thoughtful. Like, Happy especially, she definitely would consider herself the odd one out. And I am sure that me and my three sisters would also make an argument, depending on the day, that we are the odd one out in our own sister groups. But it's really hard because, I mean, your sisters are just variations of yourself, right? Like, that could have been you, but you're you and they're them. and we wanted to think about it in a different way. And because we are so close to our sisters, it was tough to sit down and write about these girls who have lost their sister, because no matter how close you are or aren't, losing a sibling is just world changing and life rocking. So it was really hard to write their relationship, but I think that it made me even more mindful about what I have with my own sisters.
I would add that relationships aren't static, you know, so they change throughout time. And even for like me, Maritza, and our two younger sisters, Jessica and Lydian, the relationship that we had as children is different than the relationship that we have as adults, you know, because we're all growing and moving and becoming able to grow into ourselves and who we want to be and who we're meant to be. And one of the things that we tackle in this story is just how you as a person, you change throughout time, and how those changes impact the siblings around you, who you think you know, who you don't necessarily, because of, you know, whether it's rivalry or, you know, anxiety, or just thinking that you have to live up to this idea of who is a good person, right? So it's just, we kind of wanted to remain true to the sibling relationship. Like Maritza said, depending on the day, yeah, you might feel like the odd one out. Then depending on another day, you might be like, oh no, like, we're fine. It just really depends on who you are and where you are at that particular moment in time. But that relationship doesn't change. It evolves. And what ends up happening is, like, if you're fortunate enough to be able to grow older with your siblings, you're able to mark those changes. Yeah. And in our story, one of the sisters' lives is cut short. So those opportunities for you to grow into your relationship, to see how the person moves, to understand their motivations, especially as you learn things about them, it becomes a totally different experience when one of those siblings isn't around anymore.
You know, that's the same thing for if a parent lost a child, because I'm a parent, I have a daughter. And if I lost my daughter, you know, in reading the changes that the mother was going through, you know, at first she was trying to, you know, keep up this strong, you know, out external when she was speaking with audiences about the death of her child in your book. But then, you know, you can see she starts to kind of crack, you know, at a certain point. And, you know, I don't know what I would do. Like, I don't know, to be honest. Like, if somebody came to me today and said, your daughter died, for whatever reason, you know, it may not be in a protest the way your character did, I think I would just first probably be speechless. I don't know. Yeah. I just would be speechless.
I'm sure it's mortifying. And that was really what we wanted to tackle in this story, or one of the things we wanted to tackle, is because when something tragic like that happens, your family is still grieving. And imagine you're grieving in the public eye now. So all of these things that you, those stages of grief that you would be able to cycle through on your own personally, which can be ugly and chaotic and whatever, it messy, whatever it is, as you work through your emotions that you should be able to work through, you're now forced to do that on a public stage over and over and over again. And what does that do to you? And what does it do to you many months after the case too? So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's like 5 stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And you can see, you know, these going on. One of the cool things you do is bring in history of the family and also history of America in terms of how America has dealt with racism. You know, one of the stories you bring in is about the grandmother and, I'm sorry, it's the great-grandmother and her fight trying to get help for polio. Mike, you want to talk about that a little bit?
I'll toss that one over to Maritza because I was talking a little bit.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah, so something we've realized as we have become writers and authors is that we're really big history buffs, which is fun to learn about myself. And we used the Negro Voters Green Book as an anchor in this story to guide characters that we have in the past who are connected in various ways to our characters in the present day. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, one of the characters' mothers in the past had polio, and something that Evelyn wanted to do for her mom is to visit Warm Springs, which is a very popular, important historical area that President Franklin Roosevelt used to rest and rejuvenate himself because back in the day. And that place used to be segregated. Black people were not able to go there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we wanted to like incorporate things that are important to the history of the country and talk about how those contexts would be different to characters in the past who are Black. So the Evelyn and her family, they have to get in the car and drive away because their neighborhood is basically about to undergo a huge fight between the Black and white residents of the neighborhood. So they use their green book to visit their Evelyn's brother in Georgia. And while they're there, they decide to stop at Warm Springs, and they find out, well, Evelyn finds out that they aren't allowed to be there. And she's so upset because her parents voted for Roosevelt. And, you know, he seemed like such a progressive person who wants to help everyone, but there are still structural powers in place that make it very clear that we aren't equal. Like, we were equal, or we weren't on equal playing fields in the 1930s, and we still aren't in 2020. So this book was a great opportunity to learn so much about things that I didn't even know about, and that I hadn't learned in school.
Yeah, I learned, I mean, the thing about the Springs, I didn't know about that. You know, you bring up Dred Scott, that I knew about. You bring up some other places and locations. And I think it's great, again, just as a book for youth, but amazingly as adult, like I was learning stuff, you know? So I think even adults would appreciate, but definitely for young people, having that historical information in there and having the characters, like they see it through the character, like they're young, they can, you know, relate possibly, you know, with the characters. Now you bring in somebody who's not a sister, but does have a major role in the book, Shakira, who's a foster care child. Why did you bring this other character in? I'll ask Maika to answer that.
Yes. You know, we had to spell out that pronunciation because we knew somebody was going to read it and be like, Shaquit, Shaquit, you know, pronounce. So we're like, yeah, it's Shakira.
Yes, yes.
But you got it. But we chose, how do you explain this? So, okay, I'll think about it this way, or I'll have everybody think about it this way. So as a Black woman, you walk through the world with your identity. You are both Black at all times, and you are both woman at all times, right? If you are woman identifying.
Yeah.
You cannot split those two apart. They are both equally a part of you.
Yeah.
Now imagine that you have this idea that in order to be a good person, you have to act a certain way. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to show different women, different girls in all of their glory, whatever the case may be, whether you want to be an actress, whether you want to be a historian, whether you want to be, you know, in the sciences, whatever the case may be. And we wanted to tackle what, when people say, oh, that person is one of the good ones, what that means. Like, why is this person one of the good ones? But so often, like when a tragedy happens, they get into all of the semantics of the person, right? Especially if it's a Black person, if it's a Black woman, they'll ask like, well, you know, where did she go to school? What was she wearing? How does she talk? What does she look like? Oh, is she ratchet? You know, it's like all of these things to be like, right. It's like all of these things to try to figure out, like, where does this person rank in our social hierarchy and do they matter? And we just wanted to show different characters and allow people to get to know them and understand who they are and their motivations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was important for us to show different folks, because those different intersectionalities that I mentioned, they can't be split apart. You are walking with those identities at all times. And sometimes people ask of you to forget one part of your identity, or they'll say, like, for instance, I'm trying to think of an example. Like, okay, like, you know, when a Black male celebrity does something, right? It's an act of sexual misconduct. And then folks will say, like, if Black women speak out and say, this person is wrong, they should be condemned for this, then they'll say, oh, well, white men get away with this. Why is this okay?
Yeah,
and they don't understand that as a Black woman, you have to contend with being Black and a woman at all times. So you carry those identities with you. And it's not something that you can be like, okay, well, my Blackness is going to lead today. When sometimes maybe it is, maybe you make that conscious choice. But for us, we wanted to show different people fully formed and allow folks to contend with themselves when they're reading stories about someone like Shakira or someone like Kezi or someone like Happy. And you're like, oh, this person is good. This one is not good. Why is that? Like, what does that mean to you? Why is this person? And understanding the different life experiences that the person has, whether you grew up having your family around or you didn't, whether you have money or you don't, like all of these things together shouldn't matter if the person has value or not. And if we are going to be, you know, better people, and, you know, everyone's always talking about believe Black women, like as Black women, we need to be able to like step up for one another, like, especially because it seems like nobody else is going to do it for us.
Right. Exactly.
So we need to be able to do that.
Wow. I mean, her story was just like, well, I don't want to give away.
I know Maritza is like, no spoilers.
No, I know. I'm like, okay, I'm trying to talk, but basically it's just really complex. And I like how they're just weaved together. And cause I was trying to figure out like, what is the, like, how is she going to get with the sisters and all this, you know, thing. And so I think it was really beautiful. You said that, you know, writing wasn't like a burden, but how long did it actually take you to write this book?
We actually did a really good thing this time around where we wrote little by little over a course of, gosh, just like a few months. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Like 6 months, Lika?
Yeah, I think about
it. Yeah. And I mean, usually we can be really bad about procrastinating, but this time around, I don't know if it was just the story wanting to come out and our outline being so fire, but we wrote diligently and got it done. And I think that having time to really get to know these characters over an extended period of time and think about them constantly for days and weeks and months really made us understand who they are and what they wanted and what they needed and what we wanted to say with our story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a tough experience to write about, but I am very proud of what we have come up with.
Are you guys PK kids?
Oh yes, we are preacher's kids.
What?
Yes, so, we are totally preacher's kids.
So tell the audience about what that means. They may not know.
Yes, so PKs are preacher's kids or sometimes pastor's kids, depending on who you ask. So our dad is a pastor who went to theology school, right? Is it theology school? Is that what it's called? But yeah, so we're pastor's kids, and that comes with a whole lot of connotation, because mm-hmm. some people will be like, oh, they're pastor's kids. They're going to be wild. They're going, you know, it's like, well, no, we aren't. We might have moments, but really.
You are complex too.
Exactly,
kids are complex too.
Yes, we're just human beings, you know, and you're just human beings. And we, you know, for us, we grew up in the church. We joke around and we say, like, we went to church like it was our job. Like, it was crazy. Like, we would go to church. It would be like Mondays would be, I don't know what it could be, like cellule, which is, oh gosh, like small groups. Like, you mm-hmm. might have different families go to each other's house and they pray or they read the Bible that night. Tuesdays might be Bible study. Wednesday, you could get the day off. Then Thursday is like a members meeting. Friday would be like watch night service. And we had watch night service like every week. Every other wow. Saturday could be youth service. We'd have two Sunday services. Like, we went to church like it was our job.
Oh my so gosh.
We definitely incorporated that within the story. And, you know, going to church, especially like growing up in our families from Haiti, so going to Haitian churches, like, it's a very, you know, it was a very strict and religious upbringing. Like, it mm-hmm. was just that's how we were brought up. And then as you get older and as you're growing through the church, depending on, you know, the type of person that you are, you might start to push back or consider some of the things that you are learning. And that really came to play within this story, because that goes kind of go back. It kind of goes back to what I was mentioning earlier about your intersectionality. Like, you can't pull any of them out of you. So yeah. Imagine if you're growing up in the church and you are Black, a woman, and queer, what that does to mm-hmm. you when you mm-hmm. are in these spaces and you're hearing people say certain things like, oh, you know, if you're LGBTQ, you're condemned, and all of these other things. And you're growing up hearing that and you're carrying that with you. And it forms your idea of who is a person who should be valued or not. And that is something.
Well, what did your parents think of that? What did your parents think of you guys writing about that topic? In the
yes.
book?
They're still reading it right now. Okay. So we'll find out. But honestly, like, especially now as adults, like, we have definitely way more agency than we had as children, and we're able to speak about things maybe in a way that we didn't as children. Mm-hmm. But we've moved our parents along to be more progressive. So we don't have any worries about that. Of course, like, if you're growing up in the church and you grow up hearing a certain thing, that's the way that you frame the world. It impacts you. You're just like, this is good and this is bad, this is right and this is wrong. Mm-hmm. But then you kind of like pull back the curtains on that. And something that we kind of mentioned within the text is like, whenever people are condemning LGBTQ folks because for whatever reason that you think like, oh yeah, I'm better, or, you know, the God is going to punish this, they use Sodom and Gomorrah as the anchor for that. But within that story, Lot literally offered up his daughters instead. Like, okay, no, don't engage in this quote-unquote homosexual act. Here, have my daughters instead so that you can violate them. But nobody talks about that part. They make it seem like, oh, Sodom and Gomorrah got burned to the ground and that was fine. It's like, okay, but what about his daughters that he was offering up literally to be like raped? Nobody has any problem with that. So when you grow up in the church, you hear these stories and they're from the Bible and it helps form who you are. But then if you want to critically examine the text, as we are always asked to do as PhD students, you start to push back a little bit. You're like, okay, well, how do you reconcile that? And a lot of folks can't. Or they'll make it seem like, oh, well, what he did was to save their soul, those men's souls. But what about his daughter's souls? Right. So you kind of, it's an uncomfortable conversation and people aren't always willing to contend with that. And then sometimes you find out folks' real colors at that point. If the person is like, oh, well, you know, it was a different time. Then you're like, okay, you could say this because you're a woman and you haven't been scared to be violated in that way, you know? It all comes together in the text and in your own life if you decide to critically examine. And it's not to condemn anybody who grows up and is religious or has faith or is of faith. Not at all. Right. But instead, it asks you to truly examine yourself. What does that mean? When, you know what I mean? Like, just to critically think, what does that mean? So we hope that as people go through the story, it allows them to kind of examine their own, you know, maybe shortcomings, or examine even some of the things that they are proud about.
What are your favorite writers, Maritza? Who's one of your favorite writers?
Okay, so one of my favorite writers is Edie Savoy, and Edwidge Danticat, and I'll put them together because I admire both of them because of what they symbolize for me as a Haitian American author, knowing that there are others who came before me who have been so successful and celebrated, but also very grounded in what they do and showing that there's more than one way to be Haitian, more than one way to be Black, a woman, a human on this earth. Yes. And all their works really showcase that in so many fun, dramatic, serious, thought-provoking ways. And I also love Ben Philippe, another Haitian author, because he is so funny on the internet, but also in his books. I wish that I was that funny. And I love reading books that make me laugh and feel happy. And I actually was going through a period of, what are they calling it? Like a writing or reading slump. In this period of self-isolation and quarantining. And it was only until I read The Worst Best Man by Mia Sosa that I was able to come out of my shell and finally start reading again. So I've been going through a lot of Alyssa Cole's work. I just finished How to Catch a Queen. And I love romance novels, and I used to read them a lot as a kid. I mean, we would just steal them from our mom. She had so many, and she was into like the cowboy covers, but I transitioned and was more gravitated, I gravitated more toward the like Regency era books. And now I'm in this like contemporary phase of like what's going on in the real world. So those are some of the authors that I am really into.
And how about you, Maika?
Oh my God, Maritza brought me back when she said Regency era books. Like, oh, it was like, you know, the Dukes and Duchesses. Yes, we used to sneak those books around. We had no business reading them, honestly. We were like middle school and high school.
What? I remember middle school?
Yes, like all of the, we had like a quote unquote book club where basically the whole purpose of the book club was to find the dirtiest romance novels so that we could all read the sex scenes. It was crazy. But
I wasn't in that book club.
He's like, remove me from that.
Thank you.
He's like, I am not a part of this narrative. I would say definitely what Maritza mentioned, Edie Savoy, Edwidge Danticat. Like, you can't be a Haitian author and not mention the both of them. But I would also say I really enjoy Elizabeth Acevedo's work.
Okay, yeah.
She's just a wonderful, wonderful writer. I used to write poetry when I was younger. Definitely not as good. But it was... something that I enjoy doing. So being able to read a novel in verse, or even when you read anything that she's written that is not in verse, like if it's prose, it still has that poetic flow to it that is just so beautiful. And I truly appreciate that. And the poet X specifically, the main character in that, Xiomara, she grew up in a very like strict religious household, and she's trying to push back and figure out who she wants. And that story totally resonated with me. Like it just, it stuck. I was like, oh my God, Xiomara is me and I am Xiomara. Like it was like really enjoyed that story. I also enjoy, honestly, anything Alyssa Cole writes, if it's romance, if it's thriller, if it, she could write a grocery list. I think I would still read that because she just does wonderful, wonderful work. Like the way that she makes you care about the characters, the way she creates these worlds around the characters. There's, it's so believable, and the pacing, like she's just truly amazing. I really enjoy the works of those two authors. Odd One Out, I would say specifically that story by Nick Stone truly resonated with me. I feel like there aren't enough stories about young people of color grappling with their sexuality and understanding what it means to be you, and not allowing yourself to be confined within this box of, you know, this is what it means to be straight, or this is what it means to be a lesbian, or this is what it means to be bi. You know, it's just like, you are you, and you are able to move fluidly within that space. So I truly, truly enjoy those stories.
So what's some of your favorite Haitian food dishes, Maritza?
Oh my gosh, I wasn't expecting this question, but I'm so excited that you asked, because I can always, I can always talk about food. Let's see. So I would say that my favorite Haitian dish is kalalu. That, I mean, I know kalalu is like a leafy green in other cultures, but for Haitian people, it's okra, like an okra stew. And I like that with beef and rice and beans. And I like rice and sospua, which is like a bean stew sauce situation. And most people eat, like it with white rice, but I'm not a huge white rice eater, so any other rice with sospua. And I love lumbi, which is conch, and I love goat, which is goat.
She took all my food. I'm like, wait.
Oh no. Okay, so wait, give Maika, what's your choices? What's some of your favorite Haitian food?
Okay, so since Maritza basically took all the foods, I was like, okay, I'm gonna say lumbi. She's like, lumbi. I'm like, great. Lumbi is conch, by the way. Okay, I would say I love soup jumu. Soup jumu, it translates to like pumpkin soup or squash soup. Okay. And it's a historical dish. We eat it on the 1st of January every year because that is Haitian Independence Day. So in addition to it being New Year's Day. But the story behind soup jumu is that when the Haitian people were enslaved, the slave owners did not allow slaves or black people really to eat soup jumu. It was something that was reserved for the elite. So when it's a hearty dish. It has you put like the noodles in it. It has the squash or pumpkin that is basically blended or pureed down. It has beef in it. You depending on the person, they might add cabbage, watercress, or different types of things like that, cresson. And so the idea was that only the slave masters could eat this amazing dish. So when the Haitian people got their independence, you know, the first black republic to claim their independence from the colonizer, they were like, we are going to eat this dish in commemoration for where we were and where we are now. And it's a national dish, and we eat it every January 1st. And I love it because, one, it's delicious. Two, it makes for a great hangover cure, especially if you've been partying a lot on New Year's Eve. And three, it has a lot of historical significance. So it's like a perfect dish.
Wow. Well, that sounds just like your book. I think your book will have historical a space in history that will be great for young people. Again, but also I think it's great for somebody. I'm 50. I enjoy reading it and I learn stuff from it. So thank you for writing the book. What do you have coming up next on the horizon, Maritza?
So we are actually going through different story ideas right now, and hopefully we'll send that over to our publisher soon. And yeah, so we can't talk about it too much.
Okay, but hush, hush.
Yes, but we can't wait to share.
Well, please come back on the show when you get your new book. I'm sure it'll be just as great as this one and your first one. And wow, you're getting your PhDs. Congratulations to both of you. You'll be doctors soon. How will somebody differentiate you because you have the same last name?
And right? the same first initial.
Right? What do you do in journal articles? I mean, like in a journal article.
Ooh. I'm just going to act like I wrote everything Maritza wrote and that'll be fine.
Yeah, me too. We'll just have everything under the same banner.
Oh my God. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much for, again, having this book, showing different sides of African-American youth, relationships, family, religion, grief, all these things in history, all in this one book. Thank you, thank you, and thank you. All right,
thank you for having us.
Thank you for putting up with the technical issues. I was just so concerned about being recorded, but I see the red button on my computer, so we're fine. And I'll edit out, if the other part was recorded, I'll edit it out and it'll, you know, just be like a regular interview. The audience won't hear this part.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Okay. So it's going to be posted on in January because your agent said don't post it till after the book.
Yes, January 5th.
Yeah, so I'm doing the 9th. I'll post it on the 9th on the website. But I'll send a little link and reminder that it's been posted to you guys so you'll know.
Yay, thank you.
Thank you so much. This was awesome.
Thank you very much. You guys have a great weekend, okay?
You too.
Bye.
And don't eat too much food.
We'll try.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you for tuning into Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I hope you enjoyed the interview with the two authors. I will be giving away copies of their books, one of the good ones. So please follow at Joy Keys on Twitter, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys on Facebook, and Saturdays with Joy Keys on Instagram. I hope you guys have a wonderful weekend.